were few in those days. I remember one on the Northampton who we became good friends with. But there was a relationship that existed here and a contact that existed which affected your attitude toward black people. More of this contact existed in the South than existed in the North. After I finished school and lived in New Jersey, we lived up there for 2 years. You could see the difference.
So you came into this with, this was not a totally different experience.
But majority of the officers, I'd say 2/3 of the officers of the 97th, at least all the general. See, the 97th was made up of reserve officers, and most of them are ROTC graduates. You had to be an engineer prior to the war, prior to the setting up of OCS. You had to be an engineering graduate to be an officer in the Army. West Point, the top 10% of the class used to be the ones that became the engineering officers. Robert E. Lee was one of them. Majority of these people, all these people were ROTC and reserve. That's what made up the 97th. Later, even after we got to Alaska, we started to get some OCS people. But 2/3 of the officers in the 97th were from the South or from the West. Most of them either from the South or the West. And I think that had a bearing on this.
I've heard that most of the officers from the South actually did better with their men.
I would say, but one of the ones that did the best was from Washington State, Mac Meekin, whom is still there, a coal faction. And I've made this statement, I don't know whether I made it to you. I think the men of A Company actually loved that guy. They had a tremendous respect for him that went beyond anything they did me. I mean, it was just, we can't do too much for Captain Mac Meekin. I mean, it was a... And he didn't do anything to generate it, and he could be tough on them, but it was a certain rapport there. And that had a lot to do with the success of the 97th Engineers.
Just questionable
what they were. Coleman, I mentioned a while ago, he was a graduate of VPI 4 years before I was, and although we were about the same age, I was in the Navy, and he was from West Virginia. He was the same kind of person. Whitworth, who was one of the surgeons, I showed his picture last night. It was Coleman and Whitworth together. He was from a graduate of Emory University and from Greenville, South Carolina. Well, you say, what's the doctor got? But the doctor's attitude had a lot to do with the morale there. But we had four excellent surgeons. The Army had a good setup on medical service at this time. We had a regimental hospital set up in a big tent. We had well-trained corpsmen. This had taken place during the time they were down in Florida being organized over Camp Blanding and then for several months over at Eglin Field. And we never had any medical problems. And I didn't mention it last night, but we had very little illness. Up here, it was almost unknown. If a man got ill, he almost thought he was gold breaking. And sometimes they were. But there wasn't much of that. We're back to the train. I got off the track. We crossed the United States in 4 days. I think the men greatly enjoyed it. We got out west, going through the Rockies, and across Idaho, and up to the Blue Mountains of Oregon and down the Columbia River Gorge, and we got to Fort Lewis and unloaded, and we had all of our equipment with us, all of our hand tools and axes and stuff, and post hole diggers and shovels and all that we were bringing up here to build the road with. It was in boxes, and we had all that stuff. Anyway, we unloaded there and then got organized and went over and got on the ship. On the David W. Branch in Nellis Bay, right on the south side of Seattle, if you know where that is. Seattle is an old town to me because I spent the summer there in 1933 when I was on the Northampton, and we spent the whole summer in the Navy Yard over at Bremerton, across the bay from. You familiar with that country? Okay. And we had, I mentioned, we have at a rifle range out at Fort Lewis, the Navy did. And
did you get any leave when you were in Seattle, or did you get
No. There were some people, it was, the grapevine knew, the officers weren't supposed to tell their wives, anybody what it was, but the colonel's wife showed up out there, and at least the executive officer, and Mac Meagher's wife even showed up there. Of course, she was from Washington State, and so they saw them. It was a secret, but it was a, some of it was open. We knew what was going they knew what was going on. They knew where we were going. I broke the rules, everybody did. I had two of these scroll maps, and I gave one to Janet and showed her how to read the coordinates on it so I could tell her later by where we were on the road. There was undue secrecy used on this project, but part of it was training to teach people if they got into a combat zone, but we didn't have any thought, incidentally, of that when we got up here we were going to be fighting the Japanese or anything like that, but there was that possibility, because a general, an engineer regiment has two functions, which one is to be a construction outfit, but it's still supposed to be able to defend itself while it's doing that. If it's in a combat zone,
you were armed.
Yeah, well, I wore 45. We did all the way through, and that wasn't because we were afraid of the men or anything like that. It was just part of the picture. All the men had rifles, and they had them in their tents, and there was one of those that one man used to shoot the other man in the gut with. But anyway, we got on the ship and started up to Puget Sound, which was old country to me back from 33, the whole Seattle area was, and went up and stopped at Port Townsend to test the degaussers. The degaussers were devices put on the ship because there had been reports that the Japanese had dropped mines in the water up and down the coast, and they had put these on while the ship was just before we boarded it, and we stopped at Port Townsend to test them. They had a range there to test them with. Then we went on up the inside passage, and I mentioned last night it was good. The accommodations for the men weren't everything that could be, but I mean, it didn't matter whether these were black soldiers or white. I mean, that ship hauled both. That's just the way it was during the war. You had down below in the holds, they could make put up 4-tier bunks and all.
Was it fishy smelling down there?
It was after we got into the open sea, and there was a lot of upchucking and so forth, and we actually, the officers had to go down there and route the men out, but the sergeants did it mainly, but get them, to make them go up on top side and walk up and down, get some exercise and get some fresh air and so forth, and some of them want to do it, of course, you know, you can get so seasick. I've never been seasick in my life, really, but you can get so sick, you don't care if you die, and but a lot of them had to literally be dragged up to do it, and some of the officers would say darn way, but it was a nice trip. The food on that ship, both for the officers and enlisted men, was excellent. I mean, that was another strategy of the Army. See, this ship was being operated by the Army under contract. And we had, I don't know what I mentioned this last night, I kind of cut some of it out. We had a gun, Navy gun crew under Chief Petty Officer Ringworth with a 5-inch gun up on the after part of the ship, which was supposed to be defense against Japanese submarines, and as we crossed the Bay of Alaska, we did this zigzag. There were actually shell marks up on the superstructure of the David W. Brunch from a previous encounter with a Japanese sub. And you'll read this in his book too, that there had been two ships, at least maybe more, sunk by Japanese subs in Alaska waters. Before this took place.
Yeah.
And I remember laying in my bunk, and I'd been to sea a lot, and I was probably more than familiar with ships and the sounds on them and so forth than most people. I could lay there and hear the ship's engines and so forth, and I could hear them every time we turned, I could tell it, and I could hear them when they change tone or somebody reset them. And I wonder, well, what if we're sighting a Jap submarine? I mean, you know, those things, because you knew you had a life jacket, everybody had a life jacket, but you knew that in those waters in April, how long? If a ship went down, your chance of survival were almost zero unless you got in a lifeboat, and there weren't enough lifeboats on it for everybody. Anyway, we got to Prince William Sound, and then we start see land again, see all the snow glaciers in on the north side there. You know where they are. And we got over to Valdez, and went in and tied up to the pier. There's used to be a long pier jutting out. I don't know what. I haven't been back to Valdez since 43. I've been trying to get down there, but I haven't. And, of course, the Valdez that we knew then doesn't exist anymore. It was just a small village, but it had stores and everything. It had places you could buy some gifts. I bought some things for Janet there in the center. And had native artwork and so forth. And I can remember buying an ice cream cone, paying $1 for it, and boy, that was unheard of in those days. But anyway, when the colonel went ashore and found out that his orders were to go to Solana, and the pass is closed, what are we going to do? So then they looked around, and Alaska Road Commission gave us their camping spot. It was a public land up where you go into Keystone Canyon. You familiar with that country? You know where you go right into Loya. One thing that interests us there, I've always liked history. They told us a story, and this story is in Milepost, incidentally, some mention of it, about the two railroads that tried to build a railroad from Valdez up to Copper Center, and they both hit Keystone Canyon. I don't know how they were going to get up through that. I never did figure out how they it was pretty steep. And they had a gun battle right there at the entrance. You familiar with that story? And Rex Beach, you know, I've read that since. I wrote a book called The Iron Trail about that incident. It's very different from what happened. But anyway, we camped there until early June. And
that's where you took some of those nice pictures of men drilling and so on.
Yeah, the men drilling and the bridge being built, which is some of the best you've got. Now, which ones do you have in your collection?
I have two. I have the bridge building and the men marching.
All right. I think it'd be good. I'll look through everything. I'll get Charles to give you a couple of things. If you're willing to, add in a couple more of it. Now, since you want to push the 97th a little bit, let's get a couple more representative ones of some tough situation. Maybe the one of laying the corduroy. That was hard back breaking. That one and
certainly you were corduroy king.
Maybe the one of making the culvert, which has a great story because the road stopped until we did that at Scotty Creek. You know, pulling the culverts in. That one would be good one, and maybe one more. Maybe let's put three more in if you're willing. I'll pick three out that represents the efforts of the men. That corduroy was the backbreaking work of it, and it represents the hard labor that the men did on the road. The building the covert represents skill by Sergeant Marshall and some other people. We told them what to do, but they did it with very just hand tools and some nails. And what you could do out on the trail. And we could write a caption for it that reflects that. And I don't know. Maybe we can. We might even put one of the cabins at Beaver Creek, which they built. I mean, I supervised it, but the men built those cabins and did a great job. They're still there. I wish you could go in and see them sometime.
I'll take a look.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to be short of tape here, so we better.
I haven't meant to stretch this out so much.
But no, it's all good detail, and we can use it. In Valdez, that's where the guy got shot?
No, that happened. The man got shot up in Mineral Lake, which is about 10 miles toward Tok from Manchester.
Okay, tell me how long you stayed in Valdez and then how you moved
We
out.
Stayed in Valdez until, or 13 Mile until the end of June.
And were you
end of
guy,
May.
Were
end
you
of,
there when that guy froze to death from the 90s?
That did not happen until the fall in February.
Okay, fine.
All right.
So
I was at Delta when that took place. And that was the only other loss of life in the 97th Engineers. We had no loss of life relating to construction of the highway itself. The one man shot his buddy, and the man that froze to death because of, I hate to say it, it's gone, but it was carelessness on the part of both the officer and the man to go out in a pickup truck with no survival gear. And then it was also carelessness to try to walk in rather than walk by a cabin they could have built a fire in.
Yeah.
And it was some bad mistakes, but at the same time, it did not, it had nothing to do with building this highway, as James Michener so misrepresented his book. And we,
in Valdez, you did some training.
We just marched and trained, and we had some maneuvers. You know what? You go out and skirmish, you talk about, you know, lay down, advance the line.
No, heavy equipment, you didn't have any.
The heavy equipment did not arrive until between the 15th and 20th of May. And that's another reason why we couldn't go in and start the road. The equipment had not arrived.
And how many members of your group knew how to use heavy equipment?
There was only one man in the regiment that, as far as I know, that had any previous experience with this big equipment. They had driven a little treaded tractor, what cleat tractor we call, we brought up here. But the only man was Jasper Hodge from New York, and I mentioned that last night, and he was selected to be, he's the man on the cat in that picture where we started out. But he had never run a cat with a blade on it, you know, a bullet with a blade.
Now, how did you learn? You just kind of picked
Well, we had these two men from the Caterpillar Company there, and they were a big help. They didn't know how to put a track on. I said that last night. But,
explain that. I thought that was amazing. You lost the track right away, right?
Well, we were a mile out, and we went over a bank up over Solana River there, and you probably know where that... The old trail went up. You know where that gravel mountain is there above Solana?
Mm-hmm.
And like you go into the basin?
Yeah.
You know where? There was an old sawmill. In fact, the foundation of the old sawmill is still there. I got pictures of it. And it was right up on the right side of that mountain. The road now goes around way up a Toa Creek and comes in on the other side. It might have been smart if we'd have gone that way, but this looked easier because of the gravel and so forth. And that's the way Mitch and some of them selected to go. But that we lost all that road in there and had to rebuild it. But we just learned by doing. Now, when they got up there and hit the sand, frozen sand, the cat slid over the bank and almost went down into the river, but they held it. But that's when they tried to back up and then the track ran off. And another cat came in around and tried to rescue this one and his track ran off. And when I got up there, well, everybody was starting to dig down. But anyway, being the motor officer of A Company, well, it failed my lot to put on. And I'm not saying this for me. I mean, this is literally what happened. I even wrote that about in my letter. So finally, everybody had theories about what to do, and they didn't know more about it than I did. And I said, if you all, well, I told McMeekin, I said, if Mitchell, if everybody will get away from here, I'll put threads on. I put the tracks on, and they did, because they all realized there was too many cooks in the kitchen. And we took a long time and dug those cats down, leveled, and had to dig down to free the tread. You saw that other picture. And that's the only way we knew then. And strangely, the Caterpillar men, technicians, didn't know either. And we put them on by running them ahead like this, and using bars and chain falls, sometimes did everything. And there were days lost for the next 2 months, putting tracks back on cats. And
did you finally find out what the way was?
After we crossed the Tanano River, we had one up on a steep hill there one day, and ran the track off. And the method you always use was get the cat down level and dig down underneath the track so you could leave the cat sitting and start the engine and turn the turn the track around. Each track ran individually, I guess. And you just had to have it down level to do that. So I had the men start to back the thing down the hill, and as they came, I just turned and looked, and the track contract was on. But if we'd ever sat down and used our heads and analyzed the problem, we'd have probably learned it anyway. But no, it hadn't been done. And it just, I don't take any credit for it. It was just a fortunate thing. But after that, we knew how to put tracks on. But I've talked to a contractor here in town that you may know, Bryce, Al Bryce. You know, he's one of the big contractors in Alaska. Charles knows him real well, and I talked to him, and he said, "Yeah, that's the way you put a track on." I said, "I wish you'd have been." I wish you'd have been there at the time.
Well, you hit. You not only had the cap problem, you had the permafrost.
Well, we hit permafrost when we started to cross the Solano River, which was up about 10-12 miles near Mantesta Lake and the Mantesta Village, and that's when we hit the permafrost. Now, the 18th said they didn't hit it till they were within almost up to the border, but near Donzac River. But we hit it early on and had to deal with it, and that's where word came up that the way you deal with it is don't touch the marsh, build your road over it with corduroy trees crosswise, and then haul gravel in, get over it, build your road without ever touching it and letting it melt.
How many total miles of road did you build, and how much was the corduroy of that?
The way I figured afterward, this was actually came off our record on the road at the time. We figured we would work on 235 miles of road between Solana and the Tanano River, and then all the way to nearly to the White River. And of that, and this is from our records at the time, and I happen to remember it was 85 miles of corduroy. Now, they could be off slightly, but that's the approximate. This is the work. The mileage is still, I can confirm that in of the total road. I can take that right on a milepost today, and that's what it is.
And once you got up to speed and you guys knew what you were doing, you changed management, so to speak, how many miles a day would you figure would be a pretty average day?
We actually made 5 miles, or maybe a little more. That's after we crossed the Tanano River. Well, even in the Tanano Flats, we did that fast. We made 5 miles. Now, there were times when we slowed down. We might make it two if you hit some bad ground, or we're cutting in the side of a hill and something like that. But a good day we made it. We actually went, we crossed the Tanano on the 18th of August, and we were approximately 100 miles from the border. And we crossed the border on the 14th of October. So if you figure out those days, that's 14th, that's less than 2 months. We went 100 miles.
Oh, I do want to get on the record the accident that happened at Mineral Lake, and the fellow who was kind of out of sorts. Why were people?
I'm gonna say something now. I wouldn't have told this to a black person. This was known in the region. Among the black people, and these were country black people, there was something and I've seen this done by white men people too, and it's. You can even see it in the Kenya. It's called, they called it yonks. I don't know how you say it, but I don't want to even record this because I'm just telling you something pretty like that. They called it yonks. And it's a case of somebody gets something on somebody and then everybody piles in on them. And you've seen that happen in schools and so forth. And this is an exaggerated case of that. But I think it may even go back to Buddhism. It's possible.
Do you have any idea what the guy did to get everybody down on him?
No, I never did hear that. He was in B Company. He wasn't one of our people. But it was known by everybody there that they started picking on this one man. And he just got so depressed down that he said, and this is what we all knew at the time, he sat down on the side of his bunk. His buddies told us. And they had gotten ammunition out of the half tracks. We knew that. And this was the only incident that ever occurred that adverse to it. And they weren't supposed to have ammunition at the time. But he loaded his Springfield and he sat down there and said, the next, he told somebody else in the tent, said, the next man comes through that door of the tent, I'm going to shoot him. And when the man came through, it happened to be his best friend, the one he buddied with and all that. But it didn't stop him. I don't know whether he realized that maybe he just hit him as he came through. And he pulled the trigger and shot him right in the gut. And it was a terrible thing. I came up the trail right after that, just shortly after it happened. This was before we reorganized and the A Company moved on way ahead. We were still assigning segments of road, which was the wrong way to do it. And he was being carried out. I remember seeing his face was just white, you know, loss of blood. And there was one of the doctors there, Lynn, gave him first aid and everything. And we were then, what, 30 miles back down to the regimental hospital at Solana. Set up out there toward the Copper River, you know where that is, where our camp was. And had to carry him back, a mile or two, to get where an ambulance could get up to pick him up. We had ambulances in the regiment, too. And put him in there and carry him back down the road. And the doctors worked all night on him, the sergeants, two or three of them did. And we had some very skilled sergeants. They did a wonderful job. They were proud of their handiwork of patching up all these holes in his gut. I don't know how many were cerebral. And they had him in pretty good shape coming along. And then they put another soldier as a guard over him to keep him from getting out of his tent, bunk. He was laying on the cot, I'm sure that's what it was. And this man went to sleep at the wheel. He wanted a drink of water. Maybe he called out and the man didn't wake him. And he tried to get up and go to get a drink of water and he broke loose all the stitches and everything. This happened just a day or so after he patched him up. So that's the story. I don't remember even now some of them, if I could talk to somebody in B Company, like what happened to the other man. I'm sure he got court-martialed, but there's a way of washing things like that out in the Army. You court-martial a man, charge him a dollar, and fine him a dollar and wipe the record clear. You ever heard of that? It's an old trick in the Army, but he didn't get the penalty he could have got because he recognized that he had been badly mistreated by his fellows.
Otherwise, morale was pretty good, and at this point, you're moving right along. You're going. How often do you move to camp?
Every day, sometimes. Every 2 or 3 days. The particular section that you would like to clarify?
Well, I'm really interested in it. When you're getting to the border, you're supposed to meet the 18th coming up. They don't show up.
When we, in Twitcher's book, he tells us, when we were across the Tanana on about the 18th of August, we were equidistant from the border as the 18th. He says we were, I can't verify that, but he's done a research on it. He says we were both about 100 miles from the border. And we head for the border. We have told the men, and we've been told, you build this road this summer and we'll go home this winter. We'll go home after it's over. And we still, at that time, thought we were. And so we head out for the border. We have good going and bad going. We had one advantage after we crossed the Tanana River that the 18th did not have. They hit a lot of rivers, big rivers, that they had trouble getting across and building bridges and so forth. The only river that we couldn't ford that we hit was the Tanana River. We crossed that first with the riverboat that came up and hauled some of our equipment over, which saved about 2 weeks, I always figured. And then the pontons that we had been promised arrived, and we built rafts. The ones behind me did, the other part of the regiment. I was going up the river. And built rafts with outboard motors and ferried it. Yeah, that was a ferry for perhaps a month until the Duesenberg brothers came in on the 25th of October and built a pile bridge across the Tennessee, which I reckon it was way up in September before that was open. But all, up until that time, there was a month and a half period there that all of our supplies, the stuff that was coming up to us to keep the road moving, all had to move across the Tennessee on a ferry, on that ponton ferry. You take about four ponton boats and put, it's just like a section of ponton bridge. You hear that word pontoon. In the Corps of Engineers, the word ponton is used, not pontoon. Pontoons are on airplanes. We had to go to the border, and from the 18th of August until the 14th of September, we were heading for the border. And there was good and bad going, as I say. We went by Northway, and the 2nd Battalion built a road into there. They were assisted some by the Duesenbergs, about a 7-mile road still there into Northway Airport. Oh, you know where Northway Junction is.
I've driven that road a few times.
Okay, it's very crooked and rough. That was put in. There's a steel bridge on it now. There was originally a power bridge. And we had very, we had a kind of a respite. You know, you saw a picture of a tent and the men and everything around it. That was at Midway Lake, and we had a camp there. The road was still moving ahead, but we let up a little bit for a little bit of recreation. We did not have a day off from it, officially, by the time we started the road until up in late October. I think we kept working then, but Colonel Robinson called all the officers back down the road. I hiked it about 12 miles from where I was, not too far to the side of Scotty Creek. He called everybody in, and he gave us all our supply, issued us our sleeping bags and some winter equipment like parkas and that stuff. And I remember he gave us a little nip that night. He'd gotten hold of some scotch somewhere else. First taste of alcohol I'd had. I don't drink anyway, but for months. First any of the officers did. One of the problems we had with enlisted men, whenever we got in contact with civilization, so to speak, it didn't happen after we left the 13-mile camp much. I'm sure it happened back in the rear, because there were supply trucks running up and supplying the regiment. And there was alcohol hauled up the road by these. Some of them were civilian drivers. One of them was George Sullivan in Anchorage, later mayor of Anchorge. I know, you know George. And he was one of the people driving trucks up there. I don't think George brought any liquor up there, but he was just a young lad then. But there were some liquor seeped into the camp from time to time. And that at times caused us problems. The men hadn't drank in a long time. They get sullen and so forth. But when anything ever got completely out of hand, we didn't have any bad fights or I mean, we may have had one or two where somebody stuck somebody with a knife or something. But it wasn't anything we didn't keep under control. But it happened whenever it did get it. Well, we didn't like it. And then after we got the road open and traffic started Beaver Creek, traffic started to roll up the road. Some liquor seeped into camp at the time, and when we got to camp at Delta, occasionally some stuff would come down from Fairbanks. But it was a problem, but not one weren't able to deal with.
Okay. Give me a little sketch now. You went over.
We crossed the border on the 14th of October, and then we're working on down toward Beaver Creek. What is it? It's 11 days now until the cat's met. And that road is just about where the present road, they're getting ready to rebuild all that section, you know, always the white from the border. They were surveying, we were down there in August. And we're going along and we get to, I have a camp about 5 miles this side of Beaver Creek, and that's the night on the 24th when Harold Robinson, I'm sure the chief engineers, I don't even know this, so somebody had wanted to be sure this thing got recorded in the papers. There was a lot of politics involved in this highway. You know that. Even Harry Truman got into it later. And Harold showed up in my camp. It was the A Company camp, but everybody in A Company was eating in my tent. I mean, we had table set up in there, and he had dinner with me on the night of the 24th. And we knew what he was there for. Why are you here? Oh, well, I hear something's going to happen with him. And a nice fellow. And the next day, he went on up ahead to be...
Was he a population staff?
What?
What was his job?
Engineering News Record. He was a reporter. Engineering News Record is one of the best recognized construction magazines in the country. They follow all the big construction projects in the United States. And he told me at the time, said, this is going to become a story, and I'm going to have some pictures, and I'll send you a copy. And he did. So strangely, in the last year, I've lost my copy. I'm trying to get one I let the have here. Although Belvoir's got an original copy of it. I one time had two. But anyway, I was up on the trailer. I didn't think the cats were going to meet yet. I mean, we knew the 18th was way down the line, somewhere back toward the White River. But our cats had already crossed Beaver Creek. And saying our cats, we had three in A Company pushing trails. And we didn't keep, sometimes we didn't keep it two of them running. But one of them was broken down, and I was down there supervised the repair of it, and they were all up ahead. And then that's when this incident took place, and the other 18th cat heard our cat and came running across the country, and they met, and I didn't make it. But I told everybody in the regiment, I said, that's one thing I got to be. I'd even written Janet, there's something going to take place real soon, and I'm going to be there if it kills me. And I didn't. Well, that's life.
Now, what you had said, and I think we've got it on the early part of the tape, that you had actually pulled through sort of a winter trail because everything was frozen solid.
That was mostly beyond Beaver. We didn't do too good probably some of that, this side of Beaver. And all we did there was just move the place out. And the next year, the most difficult part, you know, the PRA hired contractors who completely rebuilt the road. They used a lot of the road we'd built. And they straightened out some curves and improved the grade and so forth. But it was, and put heavy gravel fields in better and all that. The whole road was rebuilt from end to end, more or less, in 43. And the last part to be rebuilt, there was a fella there last night who runs a, what is it over here? You saw him, didn't you?
Yeah.
He said he had a car he was trying to drive from Whitehorse. He couldn't do it. He brought it up a circle on the boat.
The
last section of road, Critchell tells about in his book, to be rebuilt next year, was that section from Beaver Creek to the White River. And it was almost solid permafrost.
You actually put down there for the winter, right? You built cabins at Beaver Creek and settled.
We got in there on the, we were there on the 25th. I camped on the 26th. I moved my camp to Beaver Creek and I stayed there until the last day of the year. And part of the regiment was up ahead. I participated in it, but not very much, improving the road to Beaver Creek. I mean, to White River from Beaver Creek. But my assignment by McMeekin, A Company had to build the cabins. We've been told, build a rest camp there. We knew we couldn't saw the timber. We couldn't get enough. All the other rest camps had been built with solid lumber. And when you cut into these trees, they were frozen for 3 inches on the outside, these white spruce. And we knew we couldn't saw enough. So I don't know whether Mac Macon, I think it was my own idea, because I always liked log cabins. I said, why don't we build some log cabins? And maybe we can saw enough lumber for the floors and for the roof, and for framing the roof and everything. And I sat down and in a couple hours, going up, we had engineering drafts that's with us, and drew up a cabin. And Mac sent it back down to headquarters, which was back down the road 20 miles, with Robinson and then General Robinson. And they approved the idea, knowing that they didn't have a choice, frankly. And they also sent a sawmill up there, which we set up. It had a good sergeant in charge of it. That's the only man came with us, a sawmill sergeant. And we put our men with him. And we set that sawmill up right where the northern approach today is to the Beaver Creek Bridge, right in there. And we drove logs in there and started sawing lumber. And we did considering that this timber was frozen that deep on the outside, you can go there to those cabins today, and this sergeant, the sawyer, he was a good man because he sawed boards surprisingly uniform thickness. And we sawed boards, and we sawed rafters, 2x6 rafters. I gave it, made up a bill of material, the things I needed each day. And joists for the floor, lumber to frame the doors with and to make the doors. And the gable, we boarded up the gables. We made plates, we run the logs up, notched them out. You saw the man in the picture. And it wasn't a beautiful job, as good a job of notching as somebody's old timer, but it was still good enough. And I don't think we used any nails in the corners. I can't remember. I think we just laid them up until we got to the top. We nailed the top and on. We had foot edged the top log and laid plates on there. And then spiked them down into the top log. And I wrote Janet this. I went in and framed the first roof myself. I mean, the men didn't know how to cut a rafter. I had grown up in the construction business. And I cut the first rafter and framed the first roof, and they took it from there because they'd used the pattern that we worked. And I even wrote Janet, well, today I was very happy. I went out and got tools and actually sawed and hammered a while myself, just to have some fun. And all the work on those cabins was done when it was below 10 below. I don't think it ever got to zero while we were building.
And how cold did it get that winter when those cabins?
While we were there, it reached 67 below. That's what I wrote down, the lowest temperature that I remember, 67 below.
I loved your Christmas story. Could you tell that? It was about the turkeys?
Oh, the turkeys, yeah. The plane flew over. The twin-engine plane, I remember right now, out from camp. It came in and buzzed the camp 2 or 3 times, and we went off into the bushes. We figured what they were going to do. And what they dropped them down. Then it wasn't any open place that Beaver Creek then at all. It was just woods. And they dropped them, and they were in wooden boxes, and we found them. And it took 2 days to thaw them out, though, so we didn't have any Christmas turkey, but we had a ham. And all this is in my letters, too. So, we were there until, I never lived in the cabins. I stayed in the tent. We didn't have, we hadn't finished them enough to have a place to put the men, and the officers weren't going to do anything if the men weren't doing. But so when Lieutenant Jones relieved me and the group we had there, he moved into the cabins, and the men he brought with him.
And did you leave the Alaska Highway assignment at that point?
At this point?
Yes.
Well, I did on the last day of the year. I moved up. But we weren't building any more road then. But we had the men stationed at all these way stops up the road, all the way to Delta, up to Dot Lake and one other side, to keep the river crossings open. You know, they glaciated badly. And we had men all the way down to Solana on that road, at way stops. I think we had 2 or 3. That is where is one of those way stations down on the road to Solana. It's where the man froze to death, down between the Toke River and the Little Toke in there. Well, maybe it's a little bit farther than that, but back to the Little Toke, where the Little Toke crossed to the camping. I never did get back down that road after I went to. Well, after I came up, Mac and I came up to Tokat, I never went back over that road until 1985.
You were reassigned then?
We came to Delta, and I went out on leave during January, came back, and we were at Delta till the 17th of March.
In tents, or did you
get? No, we were in those barracks down there. It was CCC barracks. And there's been a lot said about. Some general or somebody said something about, oh, well, meanwhile, the 97th was freezing down at Delta. That is not true. We didn't have good fit gear, but we had clothing, and it was heaven. We were living in barracks down there compared to what we'd been. And there were some men of the 97th that wintered in tents, a few down the road. But we were living good at Delta, and we didn't always have enough food. I took a ton and a half truck on one or two occasions. I don't know, maybe in twice. The Air Force lived good. They flew stuff in. They had good food. And their PX was well stocked and all that. And I went over to the air station, their supply department, and it was a begging expedition. But they didn't refuse me. I mean, I went over and had a list of stuff, and I requisitioned stuff out of their supply stock of PX stuff and food and things like that, and brought them back and supplemented our diet with it. But we never did starve. We lived pretty good. The men didn't have the privileges that the officers had. We had some good meals in Rico's Roadhouse. And there was a fellow I asked Irene Henson last night, what the name was. She told me his name, I was going to remember it, Jones, I believe. Brown had a little roadhouse about a mile out the road, and we went out there and had good steaks and sat around and talked. It wasn't a bad life. But then on the 17th of March, we moved up to Live and Good and moved into big barracks up there. I've got pictures of it. It was a gold camp. It's where there's a big dredge. It was still a big dredge. I've got pictures of that. There's a big dredge that was down there, about where the road takes off going toward the it jogs. The pipeline goes up there. And then the road that we started to Eureka, the pipeline goes out that way. Well, let's say the present road does. What, a mile, half a mile? I'm getting coughed up. And there's a jog in the road there. And the dredge was down in there. And we lived good in there. That was a barracks. We had rooms for the men. And we had a electric plant, diesel electric plant.
You guys must have thought you died and going to heaven.
And it was excellent living. And we were there until up in April, and then we moved them into tents. It was got too crowded. And we made preparations for building the road onto Nome. And they sent these sleds up there. I showed pictures last night of a cook shack and a